Thanks to Tina for hosting this talk. I had met a guru in Bombay who, whenever anyone would thank him for anything, he would say, "Thanking me is like your left hand thanking your right hand." So he would not really accept any thanks because he said, "Who is thanking whom and for what?" My own teacher, before he passed away, his final book we were working on called The End of Duality. So I asked him, I said, in the acknowledgements, whom should we thank? Whom would you like to thank? You know, all those who have helped in the editing of the book, the transcripts. And he looked at me and he said, at the end of my career of speaking, when the final realization is that all there is consciousness, who is to thank whom? And this is the foundation of today's subject, which is peace of mind through relationships. And it just offers a very simple perspective of one's own experience in daily living to understand how, when you look at things through this new light of understanding, relationships transform. There's no reading of any scriptures required. There's no knowledge required. There's understanding, simply understanding. And it must be based on one's own experience, otherwise it is of no use. And it is everybody's experience. So we can begin with something very simple. The sheer fact that I am talking and you are listening could not have happened if we were both in deep sleep. It could not have happened if we were both dead. So because we both are conscious, because consciousness is functioning through this instrument and through that instrument, speaking is happening and listening is happening. It's as simple as that. So therefore, who is doing the speaking and who is doing the listening? Consciousness is doing the speaking and consciousness is doing the listening. It's quite simple. In the kitchen, it is electricity which is functioning through all the gadgets and bringing about what each gadget is designed to produce. The toaster produces toast, the juicer produces juice. Without the electricity, the gadgets would be dead. So similarly, the same electricity, which is consciousness, is functioning through all of us, without which we would be dead. This part is overlooked in daily living. This simple understanding that the same electricity is animating all of us, bringing about what each of us is designed to bring about by the source. This part is overlooked and daily living becomes me versus the other, not me and the other. Each of us have since childhood been conditioned and programmed by our experiences, many times painful, sometimes pleasurable. Based on that conditioning since childhood, which economic strata we were born in, which geographical location we were born in, which religion we were born into, which school we went to, which college we went to, that created the foundation of our conditioning on the basis of which we think and feel. And who created that conditioning? Did the child create it? God created it. So if we dealt with everyone in our lives with this understanding that each one of us has been designed by the source to think precisely the way they are thinking and say precisely what they are saying, the perspective changes. The whole approach of "you did this to me, therefore I will do this to you," that becomes shaky. That dynamic starts dissolving. Because you have the understanding that everyone is speaking, thinking, and reacting the way they have been designed to. You start taking things less personally because you have the full understanding that this person is exactly the way God has made them. So you might still react to what is being said, but deep down the understanding has hit home that, you know, God knows best. And like I keep finding out flaws in other people, now I know that those flaws are designed by God. And like they have their flaws, I have my own flaws. We are both flawed instruments created by the divine. And so what happens is you stop trying to change people. Trying to change people is a form of violence because it assumes that you know better than the divine. To accept people for who they are and the way God created them is to live the understanding. Because when you try to change people, you assume that you are the subject and the other person is the object. And then you pass judgment upon the object. You are like this, you should not be like this. You should be the way I feel you should be. So you stop realizing that you too are an object like the other. You take on the role of God when you try to change someone without realizing that you are equally an object. So this compulsive need to tell people how they should be starts dissolving. And when these things start happening in life, your relationships go through a transformation because you are more at ease with other people and you are more at ease with yourself. You are more comfortable with others and you are more comfortable with yourself. Your thinking mind, which is overactive, starts diminishing because that compulsive need and dialogue which is going on in your own mind starts slowing down because that need does not arise anymore. And the result is peace of mind. You stop interfering in God's plan, thinking you know best. And you will also find that you will gravitate towards people who exude this peace. When your thinking changes, transforms, the people around you, you attract or you are attracted to, there will be a shift there as well. Because the drama is no longer engaged in like it used to be earlier. An extreme example of this is when the Lord came to Prahlada, and asked him, he says to Prahlada, I will grant you any boon you want. So Prahlada said that, are you joking with me? The sheer fact that you have come and stood in front of me is enough. I don't want another boon. So he said, no, I insist. Now I insist even more because you've said you don't want a boon. I insist on giving you a boon. So Prahlada said, all right, if you insist, then I want that no harm should come to those who have tortured me. So the Lord said, what kind of a boon have you asked for? He said, because if I wish harm upon those who have tortured me, I am wishing harm upon you, O Lord, because you created them. And that is why Sai Baba said, forget this talk about loving others. At least try not to hate others and see the transformation which happens. It's not easy. The one who pushes your buttons the most, look at that relationship. That's there to teach you. Your whole life, you're not going to spend in getting your buttons being pushed and you reacting back. Is that a life worth living? Action, reaction, action, reaction, action, reaction. Your breath is getting wasted in that. And that is why my teacher insisted that peace of mind through relationships needs to be sought, because we are not living in caves. We are interacting with people, be it strangers, relatives, friends, family, people. And peace of mind has to be found through relationships. And now I will come to the second part of the understanding, which is as simple as the first part, as a lived experience. In deep sleep, you don't exist. Other people exist for you in the waking state and the dream state. When you are conscious of being, identified consciousness, this is me. But the fact is that everyone you know is an appearance in your own consciousness. Every other you know in your life is appearing within your own consciousness, not outside your consciousness. There is nobody outside you. All your thoughts of jealousy, envy, hatred, malice, blame, condemnation, guilt and shame are appearing within your own consciousness, not outside your consciousness. So your dialogue, which is always running in your mind, is running in your own consciousness. So the more peaceful that dialogue, the more peaceful you are. And when you don't blame, condemn, hate, criticize, judge others, your mind is more peaceful. That is why the new video which we put up on the channel, Stepping Into Another's Shoes, I don't know how many of y'all have seen it. It's a very short video. You know, we act as if we are stepping into another's shoes and, oh, we know how you feel, you mustn't feel good about this. But it's not true, because we are still seeing it from our own conditioning. We are still seeing it from the way God has designed us. To really step into another's shoes means you have to vacate your position completely. And if you vacate your position completely, you know that the other is feeling precisely the way they are because God made them that way. How can you not accept them? And to accept others is to accept oneself more and more. To criticize others less is to criticize oneself less. The Sargdatta Maharaj would say to criticize anyone or anything is to criticize the affairs of Brahman. So be very careful when you criticize. Because look at who is the one who is criticizing. We don't do that. We are too lost in the illusion. To criticize anyone is to criticize the affairs of Brahman. This is living the teaching. People say that why is this path of knowledge and understanding not giving us a practice, like let's say 1 hour of yoga or, you know, bhakti, going to a temple. But the whole waking experience is living the teaching. What bigger practice than this? God is providing you the opportunity every moment of your life. There is no point enjoying a spiritual practice which does not permeate into daily living. So acceptance, the quotient of acceptance starts increasing. And with that, peace of mind. In my last talk in Bombay, someone had sent a forward to me on Facebook which said, Lord, grant me coffee so that I may change the things that I can and wine to accept those that I cannot. So the end result is the sense of doership, which is what the Gita is based on, according to my understanding, just one line, that the ego deluded thinks I am the doer. The sense of doership starts diminishing. You don't blame others for what you think they did, because they are truly not the doers. And you don't blame yourself for what you think you did. Half the time we are criticizing ourselves. Why am I thinking this way? Why do I keep doing these things? What have I done wrong? That is a form of indulgence. That starts dropping away. Nisargadatta Maharaj was an angry sage. Anger would arise. He accepted his anger completely. And in one satsang of his, one man asked him a question who had been coming to him for a long time. And he looked at the man. He said, are you so stupid? You've been coming to me for 2-3 weeks now and you ask such a stupid question. And the man replied to Maharaj, but God made me that way. And Maharaj burst out laughing the next instant because he didn't hold on to the anger. What we do is when anger rises, we hold on to it. Why did I get angry? I should not have got angry. Now I better project I'm upset with this guy. That's what the average individual does. For the sage, the anger rising is a happening like any happening. In this case, it arose in his body, mind. In another instance, it'll be in someone else. And next moment, whatever it presents itself, he is wide open for that. That is the difference between the sage and the ordinary person. We hold on. We dig our heels in. Because now we have said something, we have to stick to it. Otherwise, what will people say? So you see, then life becomes less and less involvement and more witnessing. Sure.
What about awareness? In a sense, like a mother in a child relationship, when you know the child is going wrong, if we tell them that this is wrong, it's like an awareness giving to them, it's again criticism for them. So as a mother, what should you do? Should you stop the child, or you should just let it be because it's, again, he's being a God's child. So as a mother, should I stop my child? I should not stop my child? Like supposedly he eats Maggie every day. I know Maggie's bad for his health. So what should a mother's role?
Because now it's not gluten-free and vegan and... No, but the parent has to do precisely what they think and feel they should. That is why they are parents. See, the child's first gurus are the parents.
Yeah, but then again, if you see that he knows, it's not that he doesn't know that it's harmful for him, but he still eats it.
But he's a child, no?
No, but like if I stop and then it again, I'm going against Lord's this thing.
No, you are not enforcing a point of view. Stopping is very different, or saying what you feel is very different. What we do, even as adults, is we try to force our point of view on the other.
So, like, supposedly I tell him, you should not be having Maggie, you know it's harmful. He says, I'm going to have more Maggie. You know, what do you do then? You stop me, so I'm going to have more Maggie.
What are you going to do?
Then I just leave it. I have another option.
You know something? I have two sisters. When we grew up, our mother never told us the word no. She would just tell us the pros and cons of a situation or food or whatever, but she never stopped us from anything. And we all grew up so disciplined. It's amazing.
Even I did the same thing. I never said no, but I thought they'll understand, but I think it just became a habit in their lifestyle.
The understanding happens when it's meant to.
And now the realization is it.
Now you realize no Maggie.
When it comes to food habits, we tell everybody, you know, I've completely given up Maggie.
We don't feel like now it's not our mom telling us mat khao. It's just we both know, and when we were kids, we even then we knew it was bad, but it was nice. Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yes, I have to wait. Yeah, right. Like it just came to us on our own. We just stopped. Like when we stop, we stop for good. Now there is no such thing that, you know, we wanted, even if we feel like we just don't.
Any junk food for that matter, it's like it's really that very, we become too conscious of that.
Yeah, but sometimes now the children today, they try to revolt with whatever you say, even if it's a small thing in life. It's not easy, you know. Like we've been brought up very, with a lot of discipline, and we did exactly what our parents said. Like you said, we were very, they also never said a no, but we knew what was right and wrong. But today I feel kids, you know, they really don't care. You know, if you say something, they try just revolting. So those situations, it actually becomes a very big drama in the house, because you keep saying, you're not supposed to eat good food. No, no, I will eat what I want to eat, and they go eating the wrong thing. There are many more things. I'm just saying a food habit, but it's like, it's just a revolt. So in these scenarios, like you said, you should not judge a person, you should let them be what they are. Like in these scenarios, you get little, you know, confused, like how should you handle it then, you know? Like they are saying they lived all their life having Maggie and then they stop it. As a mother, I feel that it's harming his health. You know, ultimately you go to the doctor, you pay the doctor's fee, again they take the medicine, again they go back to the same habits.
You're contributing to the doctors and the pharmaceutical economy. So have you heard of Eckhart Tolle, the author of The Power of Now? You know, so he says what happens is a classic situation where two pain bodies are feeding off each other. In such conflict situations, the only way out is for one to be the witnessing presence. And the one who is more aware is the one who needs to play that role. And this is Maggie Noodles here, but most of us need so much suffering in our lives to come to that certain point where then the understanding drops on its own. You know, you could suffer and seek for a long time and you are not coming out of the suffering. But one fine day, something you hear or something you see or watch, and the transformation happens. And that is not in your control. See, it's very hard for the ego to accept that things are not in its control. It's all about control. Your own death you cannot control, but yet you want to control everything in life. Your own breath you cannot control, you want to control everything in life. You want to control all your relationships. Your life is teaching you that you are not in control. God is in control. You're not happy with outcomes, you suffer. God is teaching you that you may do what you want, but there are only three possible outcomes. Sometimes you get what you want, sometimes you don't get what you want, and many times what you get is completely unexpected, many times for the worse and sometimes for the better. This is everyone's life experience, that these are the only three possible outcomes of any decision you take. And which of these three happens is not in your control. Life will teach you that.
a natural calamity. There are many organizations which go out and out to help them. Is that the right way, or is that, did God will that? And if God will that, is it better to be just aware of yourself and spread awareness so that there is more consciousness around?
So everyone would be designed to react the way they react. A classic example which my teacher used to give was decades ago when there was on TV appearing the killing of whales, and two very famous people in different parts of the world saw that footage. One was a Hollywood star, I've forgotten her name, and one was Krishnamurti. Now the Hollywood star was so moved by what she saw, by the agony and the pain, that she started a worldwide movement of Save the Whales, and she mobilized an entire task force to convince the government that the practice is not good and how it should be changed, etc. And Krishnamurti, when he saw this episode on TV, was so upset that he got up and switched the TV off. Now we would judge that, oh, Krishnamurti just switched the TV off, whereas look at what Greta Garbo, I don't know who, did. But each did precisely the way they were designed to do. The one who was designed to take on a cause and do what she felt right followed that intuition, and the one who was too timid to do that, whose nature was not to do that, couldn't bear it, so he switched the TV off. But then here we sit in judgment that this one did this and that one did that, whereas everyone is doing precisely what they are meant to do. Those who are moved and motivated to save are doing exactly that. Someone had asked Ramana Maharshi, one activist, went there and he said, you know, you sit on that couch all day, every day, for every day of the month, for every day of the year. We are at least doing things. And Maharshi replied saying, what makes you think I am not? What makes you think I am not?
Okay.
And another example I'll give on Ramana Maharshi's subject is when they didn't have money, small ashram, some dacoits came with sticks to loot all the utensils and whatever their belongings were. So his people, Maharshi's people, got up to retaliate, and he told them, he said, what are you doing? So they said, Bhagwan, we are going to give these guys a beating. He said, but why? They are doing what they are designed to do. We should be doing what we are designed to do. Let them take what they want to. It doesn't mean we all have to do that, but he was pointing out to what are we, what is our nature, what is their nature. Let it flow.
So in the example of two paint bodies that you just mentioned, so if one is, both are, there are two paint bodies, and one is trying to give a solace to the other, but he is aware that if he is conscious, if he spreads consciousness and awareness in the other, his pain will be lessened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I am going to get through.
Truly, the only way to spread awareness is to be awareness. To be repetitive is a sign of violence. Because mostly when we are repeating ourselves, we are actually not repeating ourselves to the other, but for ourselves to hear what we are repeating. We have to be very careful and watch what is the repetitive dialogue which we tell others, we are telling ourselves.
You said about forgiving somebody and accepting somebody. It's all well and good. I can accept somebody who is not close to me, who has not hurt me, who is close to me. But say like your father, mother, brother, if they really hurt you, and you say that please forgive somebody who has tortured me, that takes another level ahead. But what happens is, when they've hurt you, you've got a hurt somewhere, and they touch that hurt. When they touch that hurt, it's hard to discern whether I'm reacting to the actual position or I'm going back to that hurt. Now, I'm not knowing how would you get to that level of forgiveness. If only you to say, yes, okay, I try and forgive somebody. But generally, to accept, say, your father's tortured you or hurt you a lot, very deeply, it's very hard to get to that level of saying, okay, superficially, okay, you get on, you forget. but there's a pain in you that gets triggered somewhere.
Yes.
And that, it is like, say, example, like say, a guy in the army, he gets shot. His friend gets shot next to him. And then in the Diwali, he hears a cracker. So he goes, you know, he knows mentally he's not at war. But that thing, he still gets that, you know, inside him. That pain is still lingering on. And he can't discern the difference between the two. So the pain, I'd love to forgive somebody who's given me this pain. But the pain is so deep that sometimes I can't discern the difference between, it's already past. So that level of forgiveness, I'm just saying, how do you get to that? To accept, you know, so that discernment is, you can discern the difference and live today for what today is. The Diwali is today, you're not back at that day.
Sure.
So I'm enjoying the Diwali, but really I'm not. I'm back there. So that other pain that someone's given you, go back to that. But really you need not go back to that.
Yeah, but if you had control, you wouldn't go back to that.
That's what I'm saying.
You see? Now, I'll tell you about two things. One is forgiveness, and one is what you're referring to. I know someone who, in childhood, they were brothers, three brothers, and their mother was, I mean, monstrous, you could say, from what he has described, that when she would walk up the steps to the bedroom, the boys would be trembling. That was the conditioning he grew up with. And thanks to that conditioning, all his relationships with women were and are a complete mess. But today, he meets his mother, sits with her, has a cup of coffee, abuses her for what she did. And she says, yes, I can't also believe I was like that. And he says, but mom, because of how you treated us, we don't have girlfriends. They don't stay with us. And she said, but how long are you going to keep blaming me? And he said, I don't know. And that I don't know is what you are referring to. Because it is so hardwired, the conditioning. But the sheer fact that today they are sitting and having a cup of coffee means he has fully accepted that she did precisely what she was designed to. And this was destined to happen, so it happened. That level of understanding diminishes so much of the pain, which otherwise would have been overlaid on it, that it brings him a sense of peace. It does not mean his relationships magically have changed overnight. It does not mean that. It could happen. We don't know what the divine plan is. But the understanding that nobody truly does anything and he and his siblings were destined for what happened has given him such tremendous peace that it's so beautiful to see. The other point is on forgiveness, which is a very important point, because this teaching, the living teaching of Advaita, has a very different perspective, you know. And I often use what Jesus said on the cross. He didn't say, Lord, I forgive them, for they know not what they do. He said, Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Because who are you to forgive? When you have the full understanding that everyone is an instrument of the divine, who is to forgive whom? The issue of forgiveness is left to the Lord. For me to say, I forgive you, I have usurped the subjectivity of God. Like, I have the power to forgive you. But if you both are instruments through whom God's will functions, the question of forgiveness, as my guru said, is as irrelevant as legs on a snake.
Forgiveness is for me to be free. Not for me, for them to be free of them. It's for me to be free. So I don't want to forgive them for me doing something for them. I want to forgive somebody for me to be free. That's what I'm feeling. That duality and all that's what I
want to understand. Yeah, so that's precisely the point, because there is no me to forgive the other. You see, the whole design of life is duality. Black and white, big and small, front and back, left and right, rich and poor. The list goes on. This is the design of life, pleasure and pain. What we have been doing is we have consistently started seeking pleasure without understanding that every pleasure you seek is calling the pain after it. As Maharaj would say, pleasure is the gap between two pains. And when we start accepting the design of life, of the duality of life, we become more peaceful, because then this need to go in one direction all the time. That's why he would say to welcome pain is a very big gift. You may not like it, but to accept pain can take you to a very deep place of peace, because you have accepted the design of life. And as my teacher said, you know, when people say, why did God create handicapped children? What harm have they done? And he would say, but nobody asks God, why did you create healthy children? Why not ask that? That is the design of life.
On the one hand, we say everything is an illusion, everything is maya. So if we are convinced of that, that none of this exists, then there is no relationship, there is nothing. And just remain steady in that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
There is no relationship.
There is no relationship with another, because there is no another. There is no relationship with another. That is the me and the other, not the me versus the other. That is why the sage is always peaceful. And that also is why the sage will not distinguish between who is close to him and who is not close to him. Everyone is the same, because the closeness is to do with the me, because I derive my sense of self from a certain relationship. So these are my close friends, these are strangers, these are acquaintances. My sense of self is invested in so many things, in material things. If I drop this just now, her sense of self, which is invested in this, would determine her reaction. It is like, I remember someone telling me, there was a couple in Bombay and they had these very expensive Chinese vases on display, and the maid knocked one down. And the wife was so upset that she started abusing the maid and saying, you know, you're illiterate, what have you done, you don't know the value of this vase, and went on a rant, and the maid was trembling. Because for her, she didn't know, you see. She dropped something while dusting. The husband was watching this whole thing, and after 5 minutes, he quietly got up and he dropped the other one. So, actually, there is no value here, you see. It is the sense of self we derive from it. I wrote an essay on driving on the roads of Bombay or Delhi. It's a very big teacher, because your sense of self and the car you are in, and if someone dents your car, he is denting me. How dare he dent my car? I was in my lane. These are all your teachers, because your sense of self is associated with your car. So your car being dented because it's my car, it's my expensive BMW, means your sense of self is dented. Because the other did something they should not have done. And then you go into a loop of reaction. So we have invested our sense of self in material objects around us and in people around us. And the same...
That means we should have that acceptance, like the bhavna.
Yeah, so for example, this falls, it breaks my heart because it's a beautiful piece which has fallen. Of course, I'm human. It's going to hurt me. And if I've paid a price, it's going to hurt me. But whether I'm going to extend that out and project it onto people and something they did, which has caused my suffering, that is what the sage does not do. He experiences hurt in the moment. We extend it in the duration of time. And that is why our time is horizontal, whereas the sage's time is vertical, in the now, in the present moment. Whatever the moment brings, the sage is responding to that, whereas we are operating in a loop of horizontal time. That is the difference.
The vertical time is a constant.
The vertical time is actually all there is. It is the
constant
thinking mind which is taking us away from it. Exactly. There is only now. And that is why there's an esoteric science in the West called the Rosicrucians. What they did, because for them the symbol of the cross was that. This is the vertical time and this is the horizontal time. So in the middle, they put a white rose because their mission in life was to reach that point. That is where the sage resides. All these symbols have very deep meanings. They are not just what we see.
So how should we react when in such a situation like this, live in the moment? Like suppose my car is met with an accident. Of course, there will be grief in me. So at that moment, obviously, I will say, what have you done? So how should you react? That moment, how do you live?
So you will react that way, but the involvement will not be there. You see, you will not get involved and like, you know, you don't want to like, you'll talk to the guy. Exactly. That stops. So the involvement stops. You deal with what is. If you need to take his number because you have to send him the insurance claim, etc., you're going to do that. You will have to do that. That's life. But you will not sulk for the next 3 days over the incident, which is what we do.
When you do that in practical day-to-day life, your children or somebody very close to you, they say you have just been very, very practical. You have no emotion.
Exactly. Exactly. But coming back to that, what my friend does, who buys a new car pretty often, because he says he can't bear the first scratch, it really hurts him. So when he buys the new car, he goes and scratches it himself. See, that is the degree. Because we cannot accept that objects decay, objects deteriorate. We cannot accept that. That death is a natural part of life. You know, sometimes I was told by a therapist this, which I didn't know. People put, you know, plastic on the visors. Is it the visors of right? Or the remote control of your TV. According to the therapist, this is an act of control. I want to control that the visor doesn't get dirty or the remote doesn't get dirty because I don't like decay. Because I am afraid to die.
Cleanliness
is a different thing. Cleanliness is different. But you know, the way we can operate, it can be quite complex as individuals.
And with the new technologies coming up, you can operate your house from outside.
So the God is the formless consciousness, the source from which the entire manifestation has come. It is not an individual sitting somewhere. It is what is.
And that's separate from us.
It is us. It is us. This is us. This is the God of non-duality. Unmanifest and manifest as all there ever is. So it is actually, God is what is. The peace with the present moment is God. Forget worshipping a Krishna or a Shiva. Forget all of that. If you are at peace with yourself and others at each moment of your life, you are worshipping God.
And being God.
Exactly. Because there is no me.
So I'm not worshipping God, I'm being God.
Exactly. Manifest.
I have a question, just taking it back to what you said earlier, that if you accept people as they are, then you accept yourself. So can you just about accepting yourself, can you just speak about that? What exactly do you accept? What about your faults,
It's the same thing. See, because for you to... let's say you criticize someone on a certain point. Like this person is, you know, he's a miser. He doesn't really like to spend his money. I have to pay money from my pocket all the time when I take him out. It is because you know what it is to be a miser that you criticize him for being a miser. If you didn't know what it was for being a miser, you couldn't criticize him for being a miser. So you know what being a miser is. So when you are criticizing him for being a miser, whom are you actually criticizing for being a miser? Do you get my point?
You have to be a miser to realize it.
You can only know what being a miser is. Exactly.
What about, like sometimes you sense negative vibes from someone. Should you keep away from them
or do you just ignore them? I mean, whatever, in that way.
What you would be designed to do is what you should honor. Supposing you feel I need to be away from this, you need to honor that, because that is the way you have been designed.
It's not like running away from,
no? Even the journalists are designed to be dead.
Absolutely. There was a video of 5-year-old boys being trained in Afghanistan to carry guns. They have been brainwashed and conditioned.
There should be some way to stop them, to tell them no.
There should be. I agree. You know, it's like someone who was a victim of terrorism was giving talks in India to school children on peace. But she was told by somebody else, you should actually be going to the countries where they are actually breeding terrorists and giving the talks there. Because here we know what it is to be at peace.
Really, I'm not sure.
Generally, when we compare ourselves with other countries, but the actual we are all actually terrorists because we terrorize others. Really, we terrorize others with our points of view of how things should be. Absolutely. It's all about control.
I think the issues of bad things should be controlled.
It's a question that different people are designed to do different things.
Terrorism is not designed to do
that. Unacceptable. You would not try to kill somebody.
What I wanted to know in the larger context of yoga, you know, that is a deteriorating age, and obviously there will be more of negativity as we move along.
I can't hear, sorry. Yeah, I was asking a sort of a broader question in terms of the declining age, you know, in terms of the yuga, yugas being, you know,
like a Kali Yuga.
Yeah, the Kali Yuga is now deteriorating. And in terms of the declining age that we are facing, morally declining, although we may be, you know, very well accomplished in terms of our material things and all that sort of thing. So in terms of that, there'll be more and more negativity and more terror. So how do we balance this philosophy along with that?
I feel it's happening on its own. I have seen so many people drawn to the spiritual path. If you look at YouTube, if you look at the West, there's so much happening. There are so many big names now that it will happen on its own. Everyone, it is happening. And this is all the price we are paying for knowing what is peace of mind. Because we are getting to know what it is to not be peaceful. That is why I keep coming back to that. Ramana Maharshi was asked, he said, how do I know a true sage is a sage? He says only two criteria. The degree of respect you feel for him and the sense of peace in his presence. And then someone asked Maharaj, that is there any benefit of listening to masters or being in their presence? And Maharaj's reply was that the trees near a sandalwood tree in the forest start emitting the same fragrance. And so to sum this up, peace of mind, which is often overlooked in daily living because we are so highly strung and caught up in our relationships, if we keep bringing the pointer to that, and make no mistake, that was what the Buddha said, which a lot of Buddhists have forgotten. He said, samsara is dukkha and nirvana is shanti, sukha shanti. He didn't say nirvana is pleasure, and he admitted samsara is dukkha. So that is the way life is designed. And Maharaj, who had the final understanding, said, I was born crying and I will die laughing because I have understood it all. Because he was at peace with whatever life brought him. So in your lives, that is what we keep pointing to, is the quotient of peace of mind. If you just keep that in the center of your attention, you will find that automatically transformation will happen. You will see whether it's really worth getting into arguments, situations, and no effort will have to be made. You will see this, that transformation happens on its own. That is the beauty of the living teaching of Advaita Vedanta, not a read teaching. you will find your own thought processes change. As Maharaj said, once a seed is planted, we don't know when it will sprout, but sprout it surely will.
Basically, it's karma with peace. You do your karma, but you have to be at peace, whatever comes.
Which you should know for yourself. And trust me, everyone has seen enough in life to know that what they are looking for is the peace of deep sleep. Because there's nobody who says, I don't enjoy deep sleep. And deep sleep is the absence of the me. That means what you enjoy most is your own absence. Your absence is what you enjoy the most, which is everybody's experience. But we don't ask that who was absent in deep sleep and who is present in the waking state. And the absence of pain sometimes is what gives the most peace. My spiritual teacher had migraine for 30 years and he said one day he woke up and it went. And at that time he realized that absence of pain is the greatest pleasure. Because if someone came to you and told you that all your pain in your life I can remove till your last breath, would you like me to do that? I don't guarantee you any other pleasures, but I will remove all your moments of pain till you die. Most of us would take that option, which is the peace of deep sleep. So we have to thank God that in spite of all our worries and troubles, He has given 1/3 of our lives, 8 hours out of 24 hours, He has removed those troubles for us because He has given us the gift of deep sleep. That is why I say we should worship deep sleep, but we take it for granted. I mean, how many of us are grateful upon waking up to say, wow, thank God I had deep sleep. That's amazing. That's amazing. That is the gift. Yeah.
I would like to, but I'm conscious that I don't sleep deeply at all.
Are you conscious that you don't sleep deeply or are you conscious that you sleep deeply?
I know that I don't sleep
deeply. And is there a reason?
I'm trying to find that.
Is it the active thinking mind?
Yeah, there's a lot of chatter. It doesn't stop.
So you know that absence of that would be really what you're looking for, right?
It is the one phase where you do get it. It's beautiful. Like,
exactly. So it'll happen.
But I'm aware that it doesn't happen on a regular basis, so. What is it mean to be true to yourself? I mean, often everybody says, you know, you should be yourself, be true to yourself. This question is always, I'm always very blank about it. Is it my conditioning? If what I've done, I have certain credentials. And sometimes I would say, I don't know. What does it mean?
It means exactly what you're saying. It is like, I'll give you my own example. When I was in school, at lunchtime, I would sit at the window and look out. And everyone would bother me by saying, what are you thinking? What are you thinking? And I was not thinking. I was looking out, which I enjoyed doing. So then I said that I must be thinking something. And then I looked in to see what I could be thinking. And I went into such a loop of regression, and then I realized much later when I grew up that I was not being true to myself. I got caught up in what the world had projected onto me. Being true to yourself is accepting yourself 100%.
Even if it's as per the surroundings, it's dysfunctional sometimes.
Whatever it be. And thereafter, what you need to do, you do. And I'd like to end on one sentence which my teacher Ramesh was asked as to the key to peace of mind through relationships. And he said, I have only one sentence to give you. Love each and every one in your life as if you created them. Really? Because to live that, what's in Nimish?
Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
If I'm not the doer, then taking responsibility, you know, they say it said that, you know, if anything happens in your surrounding, you must take responsibility. Certainly, when it comes to diseases, for example, cancer, you know, so much has been spoken about, it's because you're carrying deep resentment. And, you know, there is a lot of emotional anger which goes along with it.
I feel that if you have a human body, there's going to be disease at any point of time. You're going to have something or the other. Why add the additional emotional baggage to it? I mean, Nisargadatta Maharaj had cancer. What resentment would he have? No addition had cancer.
Sure.
So is it not really the guilt, you know, what did I do wrong? Because if it's not cancer, it's fatal. That's why it's scary. There are other. It's your body can have anything can go wrong. So is it really necessary to add this additional baggage?
It's actually a very good question, and there are two aspects here. One is, all disease is also an opportunity to look at yourself. Sometimes when we are off a certain path, the body gives us signals. So supposing for you, you are told that, you know, when you have so and so disease, these are the possibilities, the emotional possibilities, and you want to introspect and see if they apply to you and work in that direction, you will do precisely that. But supposing you are not designed that way, and I will give you a very good example. About 12 years ago, at a spiritual seminar of my teacher's, someone from Australia who's a doctor raised this very point. He had a patient who had cancer. So at that time, the law of attraction was very big. You've heard of the law of attraction. So this patient was in the advanced stage of cancer, and they told him that, look, we will cure you, but you have to take full responsibility for your cancer. And through the law of attraction, through affirmations, we will see that you are cured. And he said, look, let's go ahead, right? That patient died. Now, that patient, before dying, told the doctor that in his last days, when he went to that institute, which was telling him that this is how you should now condition your mind, this is what you should look at, he told them, he said, I've been doing all of that, but my days are getting less and less. I'm not improving. And you know what they told him? They told him, because you didn't put your heart into it. And he told them, he said, if I don't put my heart into it, I who am dying, who will put their heart into it? And he died with so much more guilt, because they said he didn't do even that properly. Look at that. That is what you are saying.
Even with I lost my dad also to cancer. He also had this guilt. He was a very regimented man, and then you know you have to see, you know, how could it happen to me? What did I do wrong? It was a big shock.
Yeah.
So I mean, nothing could be done to ease his pain, but it was a big. What did I do wrong?
Yeah, and some people ask that. Some people don't even ask that. They are not even aware to that level of what did I do wrong, to let even any further understanding permeate. And you know, when Maharaj was asked about his cancer, his answer was that consciousness has the cancer, so consciousness has to deal with it. I am not concerned. And he passed away peacefully. For him, it was an opportunity to go. I mean, you can call it pessimistic, but that was for him his reality.
You know, Ramana Maharishi was asked when he was ill, he said, I'm not the body.
And Ramana Maharshi had it on his elbow, and he would show it to people and say, Swayambhu Lingam, dekho.
I'm not the body.
Yeah.
You know, we each project our own world, you see. In Europe, these words like multiple universe, parallel universe. Is that what they mean? Each one of us has their own world. So we're all living in the same space, but in our own universe. Is that what it means?
Well, for us, it is all there is consciousness. There's one block. And we should deal with the problems of this plane, forget the others. No, I mean, forget multiple universe, singular universe, just daily living. This is our universe.